For our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service presents... This issue of the Indie Week. Kurt Benrud, substituting for John Federson this week, and our current issue dated July 7th, 2021. Before we begin, as John insisted, I want to thank the volunteer unpaid musicians who identify themselves as Alfred E. Newman and the Usual Gang of Idiots. Theirs is music to drive you mad, and we thank them for it. And our first story today strikes me as a rather upbeat one. It's called Meet the Scooter Riding Man and Dog Duo Bringing Joy to the Streets of Durham. On a Thursday afternoon in Durham, traffic begins to slow on West Main Street as drivers gawk and smile at a cherry red Vespa. Pedestrians turn and pull out their phones to take a photo of the odd spectacle in front of them. They need a picture because otherwise their friends may not believe them. This is what they see: a man and a dog riding on a scooter. The man has Ray-Bans and a thick brown beard. The dog, strapped to the man in a canine backpack, is a brown and white collie wearing bright red goggles and a colorful tulle collar with sequined stars. As they ride, the man stays focused on the road ahead, but the dog, Miss Betty White, seems very aware of the paparazzi. Her tail wags under the nylon pack that secures her to the man's back. She turns and tilts her head slightly, striking a pose. In a year of turmoil and doubt, the sight of a man and a collie on a Vespa evokes a momentary burst of joy. For David Cunningham and his 14-month-old dog, it is just another ride. Cunningham, a 43-year-old bartender, grew up in Ohio, surrounded by dogs. They were just some of the many beings running around the house with him and his 6 siblings. Since moving to Durham almost 20 years ago, he had always wanted a dog of his own, but never had the time. That changed when COVID-19 hit. Suddenly, West End Billiards, the bar where he works, closed, and Cunningham found himself alone with little to do. He found Miss Betty White in a kennel in Lexington, North Carolina. A registered emotional support dog, Miss Betty, as he calls her, lifted him out of his quarantine blues. Since then, Cunningham's buddies have told him he's become a calmer, friendlier guy. She's the best thing to happen in 2020. She doesn't have a mean bone in her body, he adds. But if she did, she would gnaw on it. A peek in her closet. Off the scooter, they spend their evenings together, often dining at outdoor restaurants or just watching The Call of the Wild on Cunningham's couch. Along with her diet kibble, Miss Betty gets a steak dinner once a week and a daily dog-friendly pupcake or donut. Every Tuesday night, the pair hits a local restaurant for date night. While Cunningham orders off the menu, Miss Betty snacks on a dairy-free peanut butter cup from her favorite dog bakery, Oliver's Collar. She likes Reese's just like her dad, Cunningham says. She earned her name because of her distinctive fur and as a tribute to the legendary actress. With her big old white mane like that, I was like, it's gotta be Betty White. But there's only one Betty White, so I insist people call her Miss Betty White. True to character, Miss Betty gets dressed up before an outing. A peek into her closet reveals dozens of outfits and accessories, complete with sequins, pom-poms, and ruffles. She has a rainbow tutu, denim overalls, and her naughty Santa Claus outfit, named because it's slightly too small and her booty sticks out, according to Cunningham. Though luscious, Miss Betty's shiny coat comes with a price. It has made vacuuming a crucial part of Cunningham's daily schedule. That, along with her anti-shedding shampoo, ensures that his couch and cargo pants aren't completely covered in dog hair. Cunningham walks Miss Betty at least a half mile four times a day. They go to the dog park once a week, and on the weekends they take hikes around the Eno, the Duke Forest, or the Al Buehler Trail. Miss Betty also has regular doggy dates with her best friend Jack-Jack, a little beagle-looking thing, who lives in the neighborhood. Miss Betty White's active lifestyle keeps Cunningham in shape. He says he's lost weight since he's gotten her and developed a tan from being outdoors so often. Damn, I'm beautiful. She isn't always as sweet as she looks. When she gets restless, Miss Betty can misbehave. On one such occasion a few months ago, she chewed up the molding around Cunningham's door. He put her in a crate when he left home after that, until his guilt became too strong. Then Cunningham discovered the Furbo, a remotely operated camera that lets you see, talk, and toss treats to your dog when you're not home. It's even got an infrared camera so he can see Miss Betty in the dark. In between customers at the bar, Cunningham will open the app to find Miss Betty White laying in the windowsill like a cat. He'll use the microphone to get her attention and then shoot a few treats onto the rug for her to find. She has become something of a local celebrity. During their scooter rides, drivers often swerve to take photos to post. To Cunningham's surprise, Miss Betty's fan club stretches beyond Durham. He said she's been recognized in Hillsboro without the scooter. For fans who want to keep in touch with Miss Betty, she has her own Instagram page. One post reads, "I love my human. Steak and eggs for breakfast? Was not expecting that. Bathed, nails trimmed, and brushed. Damn, I'm beautiful," says another. Cunningham grins. "I'm that guy. I used to make fun of those guys, but now I'm one. I show my dog off like she's my girlfriend or one of the kids." One post of Miss Betty as a puppy sitting in the grass is Cunningham's favorite. He's thinking he may get it as a tattoo. Their scooter rides always end the same way. After parking the Vespa, Cunningham removes his helmet, exposing his bald head. Miss Betty gives him a joyous lick. And that article was by Nicole Kagan. The next article is by Carol Espinoza Jane. 15 minutes. Audrey Walsh, 20, and Lila Richardson, 20. UNC Chapel Hill students Audrey Walsh and Lila Richardson are members of Feminine Waste, an art, music, activism, and skate collective. Last spring, they teamed up with the art curating class project Nowhere Collective to create Feminine Waste x Nowhere Collective Comp, an album uplifting women, minority, and LGBTQ plus artists. What prompted the collaboration? Walsh says, "It happened as a function between the curatorial class, technically our final project. Me and a bunch of the students decided to contribute to this collective by organizing the comp album, and we called ourselves the Nowhere Collective." And side note here, they spell that N-O, and then a W in parentheses, and then H-E-R-E, and then collective. So every time I say Nowhere Collective, that's what we're talking about. "It was based in identifying the Chapel Hill art community and knowing that we wanted to emphasize a community feeling. There was this overarching feeling like, I want this community to feel big. It's hard to have that happen during COVID, so that's a feeling we all shared." Richardson adds, "Speaking on the arts community of Chapel Hill, or making music, Audrey and I have this experience of it being isolated, especially for non-cis men or queer voices. We're trying to also identify and create a space to validate those voices." Why release an album specifically? Walsh says, "We wanted Feminine Waste initially to be an art collective focused on all different disciplines, visual art, music, poetry, and how that all works within the community. So it was stepping onto that opportunity and having the familiarity with what feminine waste is in terms of emphasizing different community and collective-based things. Richardson says, "What's so cool about the whole space is thinking about what you're passionate about, who you know or what you want to know further, and then just making it happen. Audrey wanted to do a comp album of musicians, and we thought about combining poetry within that and creating a comp album with a twist, including some poets. All proceeds are going to the Trans Justice Funding Project, LGBT Books to Prisoners, and For the Gwarls. Why these organizations?" Walsh: "When thinking about making money off of anything at this point in my life, I'm like mutual aid, giving it away, reallocating it. It was without question that if we're going to sell anything, we should give the money to different organizations that are about the stuff that we are about." Richardson: "The Gwarls are doing good work for getting housing for trans, BIPOC individuals, and top surgery. So I feel like having a space that is prioritizing these voices, the money should go back into the community." How would you describe the album's sound? Richardson: "I would say punk, indie, spacey too. Every time I think about the album, I think of friends or community, which is really nice because all the people who are on there know of each other or are affiliated in connected ways. It feels small in a good way." Walsh: "Something else that comes to mind is that it's so comforting. Maybe it's because the place that it comes from is based in these connections that feel really sweet. But yeah, it is like this small comfort music, comfort poetry that feels like a hug when we can't hug very much." Richardson: "It also sometimes feels like a twisted wire because the poetry contrasts very well with the music. So you're jamming, feeling the vibes, and then the next poem is so incredible and dark." Feminine Waste X Nowhere Collective Comp is available to stream and download at Bandcamp. Next article is by Courtney Napier. It's titled Voices. Poor communities are not devoid of hope or role models, just resources. As I was putting the finishing touches on a story covering the reopening of John Chavis Memorial Park last month, friends on social media alerted me to some disturbing comments made by District A Raleigh Council member Patrick Bufkin. He claimed to be paraphrasing Durham Mayor Steve Shewell when he said, "Don't build projects that house only poor people. These are places that are devoid of hope. There are very few role models for the children that live there, and a much better way for the community is to have this mix of incomes, people from different backgrounds, people from different means helping each other to learn how to live together." Though most of his colleagues chose not to address those ignorant and false statements, some of the community did. Fair housing advocate Wanda Coker, Nicole Hextall-Bennett, a member of the Planning Commission, and historian Carmen Cawthon all penned thoughtful and vulnerable rebuttals to Bufkin's comments. Yet instead of honoring their lived experience and apologizing for causing harm, the self-identified anti-racist called the criticisms gotcha politics, and then added, "It saddens me that instead of focusing on the work of building a stronger community for everyone in Raleigh, some have chosen to distort my comments in an attempt to score political points." Those who understand the history of Raleigh know that across from Chavis Park was Raleigh's first public housing complex for black residents. While writing my article on the park, I met former residents of the community. The way they spoke about their neighborhood was very different from the way Bufkin describes life in a project that housed only poor people. Ms. Virginia Talley was intent on communicating the pride her family and neighbors took in their apartments. "They were apartment homes," she said, with added emphasis, then described the pride of place so often attributed exclusively to homeowners that was alive and well in her community. Another former resident named Darnell Henderson remembered growing up in Chavis Heights and playing baseball, football, and basketball at the park as a child. He went on to coach the Chavis Park basketball team and led the team to its first championship victory. Years ago, while I was curating the first Black Oak Society zine, Carmen Cawthon taught me about Jesse Copeland, a tenant organizer for Chavis Heights. She baked cookies for the neighborhood children by day and advocated for the rights of their parents by night. Demetrius Hunter, a Raleigh native and business owner, remembers riding in his father Zelb's truck that was converted into a mobile produce market and served healthful, farm-fresh foods to the residents, with special attention to the single mothers and elders. No one had a lot, but they had each other. That is, until the city decided to redevelop the property into mixed-income housing. The part about this kind of redevelopment process that often goes unsaid is that, unless the developer decides otherwise, some residents will be kicked out of their neighborhoods and never able to return. Converting a neighborhood that exclusively serves low-income families to one that serves, quote, everyone, may be more beneficial to the city's bottom line, but it is devastating to the fabric of a community. Bonds will be broken. Children will lose friends. Parents will lose the people who kept a watchful eye over their children while at work. And those elders will lose the young, energetic people who help bring their groceries in from the car or rake the leaves for them in the autumn. The other myth, in Bufkin's words, is that mixed-income neighborhoods result in socioeconomic harmony, helping people of different backgrounds learn how to live together. What Bufkin is referring to, as described in sociologist Michael Banton's Order of Racial Contact, is called institutionalized contact, when the dominant class comes into the community of the marginalized class to, quote, improve it or otherwise redefine it. Bufkin's comments suggest that if Raleigh changes Heritage Park from traditional public housing to mixed-income housing, it will be making something devoid of hope, a community of only poor people, into much better, a community with fewer poor people and more wealthy people. That, in turn, will result in poor people and wealthy people building relationships and repairing the wrongs of discrimination and inequality. This is not on the minds of the most upper-income families moving into gentrifying communities. I would challenge those newcomers to Raleigh's historically black neighborhoods to comment below this piece and state the names of those neighbors whose properties their new homes cast a shadow over, or the last time they invited them over for dinner. When's the last time that neighbor has called you for help or you have called them? These things happen with trust and vulnerability, two relational features that wealthy newcomers often forget to unpack, along with their ski equipment and old paperwork. In Eduardo Bonilla Silva's book, Racism Without Racists, Colorblind Racism and the Persistence of Racial Inequality in the United States, he discusses that even when white people are in racially integrated spaces like neighborhoods, schools, or workplaces, they rarely develop meaningful relationships with their black peers. He also observed that, despite this, white people too often believe they have a much closer relationship to the marginalized people in their world because of that proximity. When pressed to share the specific nature of those relationships, what is the name of your black best friend? When is the last time you went out for drinks with those colleagues? It becomes clear that there is no real relationship, just cordial observation. When I have spoken to residents of historically black or disinvested communities in Raleigh, I hear a cautionary tale. My friend Chalisa Williams talks about going on her morning walk and feeling like she is out of place in her downtown neighborhood. Raleigh native Johnny Blaylock shared a story of how newcomers to his neighborhood walk past him while he tends to his garden as if he is invisible. Other residents speak of feeling endangered as new white neighbors call the police on young people gathered on the corner or upon hearing loud music and conversations at night. Bufkin's remarks reflect the paternalism emblematic of colorblind racism. It's the belief that poor people of color are ill-equipped to care for themselves and their children, so they need the wealthier white people to come into their communities to show them the way. While it is not hateful language by any means, and Bufkin's heart may be in the right place, his analysis lacks any semblance of reality. Poverty does not diminish a human being's capacity to love, lead, and innovate. Many religious and spiritual traditions suggest the exact opposite, and data show that the isolated socialization of the dominant classes impacts their ability to empathize with marginalized people. But what poverty does do is starve individuals of the resources afforded to others, leaving them fewer options as they seek to care for their families and neighbors. Displacing people from their homes creates anxiety, upheaval, and anger. It renders people powerless to do what they were created to do, to provide stable and nurturing homes and communities in which to raise their young. The answer to the suffering of Raleigh's low-income families is not to break apart their village and stick in some wealthy families. It's to give them the resources they have long been denied, that have been stolen from them for generations, and stand back as their neighborhoods burst forth with the most beautiful, flowering humans the city has ever seen. And now an article by Lee Toss. Several new high-rise buildings promise to change the downtown Raleigh skyline. The Raleigh skyline could look very different soon. A slew of new projects in development, consisting of 20 to 40-story mixed-use towers, will bring added density, housing, offices, and commercial space downtown. In total, these projects could add more than 200 stories of height, creating a denser, taller city center. But there's no way to know just how much taller the city could get. The city's planning office doesn't track building height, as city code doesn't include height maximums for projects taller than 7 stories, Raleigh planning director Ken Bowers explained. So when developers apply for projects, there's no restriction for how high they can go. Everyone knows PNC Plaza is the tallest building in the city at 32 stories, but the city doesn't keep an official record of its height. According to Emporis, an online database, it stands at 538 feet, followed by True Hanover Square at 431 feet. To complicate matters, the height of each floor in a building differs from project to project, with office and commercial spaces typically several feet higher than residential projects due to greater infrastructure needs. When looking ahead at these projects, all we have, for the most part, are estimates. While zoning will allow up to 40 stories for 7 projects, it's unlikely developers will actually construct buildings that tall because doing so is just really expensive. If they did, estimating an average 15 feet per floor, that would add more than 3,000 feet of height to the city. That's akin to 6 PNC towers. Here's a rundown of what we know about the projects. 321-327 Hargett Street and 213 South Harrington Street, located a block west of City Hall in the city's burgeoning warehouse district, this project could allow the construction of a 40-story mixed-use tower on a half-acre block currently zoned for up to 12 stories. Developer Highwoods Properties also acquired a 6,500-square-foot parking deck nearby. The Planning Commission unanimously voted to approve the project in June. A public hearing will be required before the City Council votes on the project. 333 South Dawson Street. This project, A block from Nash Square is currently a Firestone auto shop in an area zoned for up to 20 stories. The new tower will be zoned up to 40 stories with a mix of uses, including up to nearly 500 residential units, which the developer, RALDD2 LLC, notes in the application is likely to slow the rate of increase of housing costs nearby by adding units to the marketplace to meet the steady rising demand. The city's planning commission is expected to vote on the project by the end of summer. 215 McDowell Street and 123 West Hargett Street. Dubbed the Nexus, this is one of the more hotly anticipated projects in the city, which aspires to transform a 3.3-acre site located across from Nash Square into an up to 40-story mixed-use development. Formerly the offices of the News and Observer, the property was purchased by California-based firm The Acquisition Group for $22 million in 2017. Original plans called for two towers, two stories each, for offices and residential units. However, the developer increased the request to 40 stories to allow for more flexibility, according to the Triangle Business Journal. Approval is currently pending. 400 and 410 Glenwood Avenue. Located in the heart of the city's nightclub district, this historic building with a nightclub and restaurant would be transformed into an up to 40-story tower with shop fronts on the ground floor. The request from New York-based firm Turnbridge Equities includes a historic easement to preserve the frontage of the building, known as the Creamery. This request is still pending. 320 and 328 West South Street. This request for a 20-story tower is located near Red Hat Amphitheater. The request, which has been already approved, allows the developer to choose between two options, either 300 residential units with commercial storefronts on the ground floor, or 211,000 square feet of office space. 330 West Hargett Street and 119 South Harrington Street. This site is currently the location of Legends Nightclub. The property was sold to developer City Platt last year for $4.3 million. While the rezoning request is for 40 stories, the developer has said it doesn't intend to construct a tower that high, but wants to keep the options open. 506 Capitol Boulevard. Currently zoned for up to 12 stories, this project, known as Smoky Hollow Tower, could add another 40-story mixed-use tower to the intersection of Peace Street and Capitol Boulevard. Zimmer Development Company says the project could include more than 1,400 residential units. The site is located near several other planned and in-progress projects from John Cain, which city officials have described as a new gateway to downtown. The project was greenlit by the City Council last fall. 615 West Morgan Street and 117 South Boylan Avenue. Developer Crockett Family Properties has been granted approval for an up to 20-story tower for this site, currently a vacant lot. This site is next to the Origin Hotel and a block from Morgan Street Food Hall, in a transition area between the Warehouse District and Glenwood South Club District. And finally, 220 East Morgan Street. This site is currently a parking lot and has been approved for an up to 20-story tower. The current owners hope to sell the lot to an interested buyer to develop it. The City Council has already approved the request. And now an article from Durham County by Thomas E. McDonald. GOP lawmakers want a school ban on the portions of American history that may make white students feel uncomfortable. North Carolina legislators are expected to vote soon on a GOP-led bill that proposes to make white people feel less uncomfortable with the negative aspects of this country's history. America just celebrated its 245th birthday amid growing polarization about the truth of its origins, including the genocide of indigenous people and the enslavement of kidnapped Africans by European settlers. The legacy of those atrocities persists to this day. Nonetheless, North Carolina legislators are expected to vote soon on a GOP-led bill that proposes to make white people feel less uncomfortable with the negative aspects of this country's history. Among its provisions, House Bill 324 seeks to prohibit public school teachers from teaching that the belief that the United States is a meritocracy is an inherently racist or sexist belief, or that the country was created by members of a particular race or sex for the purpose of oppressing members of another race or sex. The bill passed the House in May by a 66-48 vote along party lines and has been referred to the Senate Education, Higher Education Committee. Supporters of the bill claim that the legislation's intent is to forbid the teaching that one race or sex is inherently superior, or that someone by virtue of their race or sex is inherently racist or sexist, and that someone's moral character is necessarily determined by their race or sex, which are all provisions of the bill as well. Critics say the bill's true intent is to undermine critical racial theory, or CRT, an academic concept that views systemic racism as a fixture in the country's DNA. House Bill 324 formerly joins a chorus of right-wing fear echoing in state houses across the country. So far, six states have passed anti-CRT legislation, and another 20, including North Carolina, have introduced or plan to introduce similar legislation, according to analysis by the Brookings Institution. In Durham, the city council and school board each adopted resolutions opposing HB 324. It's a manufactured issue and a manufactured concern that's really a partisan issue being used to divide people, Natalie Bayer, a Durham County school board member, said. It's not based in fact, and it is being used by the right wing to drum up their base without having any basis in factual concerns. North Carolina Central University law professor Irving Joyner also said the CRT debate was manufactured and created to distract, mislead, and politicize efforts to assist people to understand and remedy the racial bias, antagonism, and discrimination which continue to exist in this country. It is also another justification for attempts to rewrite or hide the real racial history which has guided and continues to guide the thinking of too many political leaders and their followers, Joyner added. A prominent opponent of CRT is Mark Robinson, the state's first black lieutenant governor, who believes the discipline is part of a growing anti-American sentiment and rooted in socialism. Those who oppose the bill disagree. We try to be leaders for truth and equity in school districts across North Carolina, equity in the Durham community and across the country as we wrestle with the painful truths of our history and work towards reconciliation moving forward, Bayer said. Joyner, the NCCU law professor, noted that CRT has been a very popular course over the years at the law school. By law, there was racial discrimination in this country, and it broadly provided negative impacts upon its intended victims, he said. Some of the most foundational cases in American law centered around the law's treatment of racial minorities. The understanding of this treatment begins with a reading of the U.S. Constitution and is confirmed in the Dred Scott and other race-based pronouncement decisions. If adopted, HB 324 would render teachers inflexible and leave students ignorant of the context that has created racial disparities in health, wealth, and education, Durham Council member Deidreana Freeman said. It's almost like they're trying to whitewash critical race theory and why we need it, Freeman said. It's not that black people choose to be unhealthy or choose to be uneducated. Chief among the points in the school board's resolution opposing the legislation were disagreements with the bill's requirement that public schools not promote the belief that America was created by white men to oppress others. The school board's resolution asserted that a sound education, including accurate facts about all aspects of American history, including systemic racism and discrimination, is guaranteed for every North Carolina student in our state's constitution. The resolution also noted that CRT is a valid discipline that seeks to understand how racism has shaped the country's laws and how those lives impact the lives of non-white people. Critical race theory, the resolution states, does not attack individual students for their privileges, but rather makes them aware of how different systems in the United States discriminate against others. The school board's resolution also noted that in 2019, the state's Board of Education adopted a strategic plan that defined equity as a guiding principle and recently approved social studies standards to ensure that a more comprehensive, accurate, and honest history was taught to all students, including teaching on racism, identity, and discrimination. It's important for teachers to be able to teach children to think critically from primary sources, Bayer, the school board member, said. And as we are more honest about our history, we can learn from the past. Don't censor teachers. We don't ban books. We teach children to be anti-racist. And an article by Sarah Pequeño. Members of UNC's black community demand that the university ensures their safety. Black UNC students, staff, and faculty are demanding more from their institution of higher learning. In a Wednesday press conference at the Sonia Haynes Stone Center, a coalition of the Black Student Movement, the Carolina Black Caucus, and the UNC Black Graduate and Professional Student Association outlined the 8 priorities members say the university could accomplish within the fall 2021 semester. Life is about relationships, and right now the relationship between the University of North Carolina and its black students, faculty, and staff is broken, said J.C. Field, a UNC Athletics staff member and the advocacy co-chair for the Carolina Black Caucus, at the start of the meeting. The press conference follows Nicole Hannah-Jones' announcement that she will not be coming to UNC Chapel Hill and will instead take her talents and expertise to create Howard University's Center for Democracy and Journalism alongside writer Ta-Nehisi Coates. The group is demanding the termination of interim police chief Rasheem Holland, who has been acting as chief since mid-May and was shown in footage of the June 30th protest at the UNC Board of Trustees meeting. In these videos on social media, campus police shove protesters out of the board's conference room and into the adjoining hallway. The confrontation included a moment when an officer struck a student with his cell phone, knocking off her face mask in the process. The student, BSM Vice President Julia Clark, later tweeted an image of the bruise on her cheek, which she says was left by Holland. The Black Student Movement has released a statement on Holland's recent appointment. Not only does his pending promotion create a clear and present threat to the safety of black students at UNC, but it further demonstrates this university's commitment to the suffering of black students and their comfortability with violence being perpetrated against us, the group said. When asked about potential repercussions for officers involved in the incident, a spokesperson for Risk Management Vice Chancellor George Battle said he has seen the videos from social media. Battle said the UNC police followed protocol and would not comment on any potential investigation or punishment. The Indy requested any footage from the Carolina Inn or from Officer Holland's body camera, as well as any disciplinary records for the day, but none have been produced. We respect the right of our community to peacefully express themselves, but the law is clear that demonstrators cannot disrupt public meetings and proceedings, Battle said in a press statement. The situation was resolved with no injuries, and proceedings were able to continue without further interruption. The officers on the scene dispute the allegation made by the demonstrators. However, any time an individual makes a claim of excessive force, UNC police will review the claim. The coalition is demanding the integration of UNC anti-racist alerts, a grassroots initiative to alert students of white supremacists on or near campus, into the traditional Alert Carolina system. In previous years, neo-Confederates have been allowed to walk around Franklin Street and close to the grassy space where Silent Sam once stood, with no incoming information from the university to students who may be targeted by violence. Additionally, they want to see black counselors and employees at UNC Campus Health, the Women's Center, and the school's Title IX office so students and others can receive help for racial trauma. Aside from safety, the group is focusing on equity in symbolism on the North Carolina campus, including a permanent James Cates Memorial, rehabilitation, and a possible reassessment of the Unsung Founders Memorial on McCorkle Place. The coalition members also discussed creating equity in academic settings through action items like including the school's grade appeal process and equal opportunity and compliance office information on all professor syllabi, equity scorecards for each UNC Chapel Hill department using data from complaints and exit interviews from faculty, and revitalizing programs meant to recruit talented black faculty members and creating strategies to retain them. We have chosen items we feel could be accomplished within the next 6 months if the university truly makes the commitment that they made to us publicly and behind closed doors in meetings that they've had with us, Black Student Movement President Talija Teddy Van told the press. Understand that we are on the ground for this next full academic year and for this summer doing everything that we possibly can to get all of these demands met. Some of them, I think, are critically important to have before the fall, those being having EOC and grade appeal information on syllabi, as well as having anti-racist alerts put in place in the Alert Carolina system before we go into the school year and after such an incredibly polarizing year, Van continued. So understand, in the next few weeks and months, we are holding the university's feet to the fire. We want to see action taken on these demands. These are actionable items. And another article by Sarah Pequeña. Residents of Orange County's Ridgewood Mobile Home Park are organizing after a hedge fund acquired the property. Alejandra Rivera was already working less than usual when she had to undergo surgery in February. The nail technician used to do at least 8 sets of nails a week. The pandemic brought her down to 2. When she couldn't work at all for 12 weeks, her 20-year-old son left school and picked up a full-time job. She wants to go back, but a new increase in the rent at Ridgewood Mobile Home Park may mean it's impossible. They're going to raise the rent up to 40% for some, but they have not responded to the serious health and safety concerns that we have, Rivera says in Spanish, translated through a supporter. They are squeezing us. Rivera is one of 4 residents who spoke at the entrance of Congressman David Price's office on June 29th. But they represented a group of about 40 residents who were struggling with their new landlords an LLC owned by the hedge fund Alden Global Capital, a group also known as the Destroyer of Newspapers, for its consumption and decimation of regarded newsrooms such as the Chicago Tribune. In April, the new owners sent out a new lease agreement to residents regarding rent increases that they were told they had to sign by June 30th. The information was sent in English, despite nearly all of the households in Ridgewood speaking only Spanish. The contract also states that residents will be charged for water and septic use, even though they use well water. We also tried to talk with the owners through the managers to try to negotiate with them that they do not increase our rent again, since we are going through a pandemic and the rent increases range from $65 to $150 for some of my neighbors, Rivera says. The group of residents organized a press conference with their supporters, asking Price to intervene in the contract negotiations on their behalf. Aside from rent increases, the group has concerns about sewage buildup and dead trees that could damage their homes, as well as the contractual inability for them to sell their mobile homes directly. Now they must sell to Smith Management, the LLC, or move them off the property. Jane Gump, a retired widow and 27-year resident of the park, says her rent has increased by $150. She also brought photos of her backed-up septic system, which is pooling in her yard after being cleaned the month before. She has been told by the property managers that the new owners are preventing them from submitting and fulfilling work orders. That will just increase and overflow into the next yard, and children play there, Gump says. The issues between residents and their new landlords is not new. They previously tried to work through their concerns privately, but couldn't resolve them. Julia Sendhor, the media relations coordinator for the residents and a community organizer at Orange County Justice United, says representatives of Smith Management were surprised when they received a call from the group and told them not to call the company again. "We were trying to figure out the right moment, and then it came all of a sudden," Sendhor says. The Indy contacted two employees of Smith Management for this story, but neither responded to requests for comment. In a press statement last week, Price said that while he couldn't directly solve private housing disputes, he planned to speak to residents on July 6th, after this story went to print. "Too many residents are being pushed out of their homes due to rising rents, low wages, and unsafe conditions," Price said in a statement. "We must work at every level of government to make housing a priority and ensure families can stay in their homes." The group also plans to speak to the Orange County Housing and Community Development Department on Wednesday. Although the community has a Chapel Hill mailing address, it is outside of town limits and under jurisdiction of only the county. For now, Sendhor says the majority of the residents have signed contracts, but will keep trying to negotiate and work toward potential litigation. And now an article by Rose Hoban. North Carolina Medicaid switches to managed care. Patients and providers wait to see how it will play out. Dave Richard woke up at midnight on July 1st, sent a few emails to legislators and to people on his work team, and went back to sleep. It was a rather unremarkable evening, and by his account, a peaceful sleep for Richard, given that something remarkable was happening. Midnight was the time that the state's Medicaid plan made the big switch over from being a state-run and managed program to care for millions of low-income North Carolinians to being a program managed by private insurance companies. Richard is the program's director. About 1.6 million out of the state's more than 2.5 million beneficiaries were moved into the managed care system at midnight. About 1.2 million of those people are children under the age of 21. The remaining people, primarily people with mental health, intellectual, and developmental disabilities, people with traumatic brain injuries and other beneficiaries who need more intensive services will be moved to managed care in the middle of 2022. 5 companies were chosen to provide managed care services to the state's beneficiaries: AmeriHealth Caritas, North Carolina; Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina / Healthy Blue; Carolina Complete Health; United Healthcare of North Carolina; and WellCare of North Carolina. In addition, the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Indians has a separate contract to provide managed care Medicaid to its population. Last big state. Until Wednesday, North Carolina's Medicaid program was wholly administered by state employees who paid the bills submitted by doctors, made the decisions around authorizing some forms of specialty care, and managed all of the logistics of the program. All that work cost about $14.8 billion in 2019. The price tag bumped up to $16.8 billion during 2020 with spending on the pandemic. State expenditures for the past 2 years have come in just at $3.8 billion, with the rest of the tab being picked up by the federal government. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, about 70% of the nation's Medicaid beneficiaries have their care administered by a managed care company. Before July 1st, North Carolina was the largest state in the U.S. that did not have a significant number of patients being managed by commercial managed care. In the past, Medicaid was a fee-for-service system where doctors, hospitals, and other health care providers were paid for each visit, test, procedure, and intervention. For instance, a doctor treating a patient with diabetes would get paid separately for the provider visit, each blood test, the check on the patient's feet — people with diabetes frequently have problems with their extremities because of poor blood flow — and a nurse to teach that patient about how to manage their insulin. These costs would add up. For patients, at least at first, things could seem pretty much the same. The differences may be subtle at first. With managed care companies, those same doctors, hospitals, and other health care providers deliver the care for patients for a set fee. For those providers, manage that patient's care. In the past, there were few parameters around delivery of quality care, so the managed care companies and providers would make money by cutting corners on patient care or denying those patients their care outright. With managed care these days, there's more of a focus on delivering quality outcomes. Now, for that same patient with diabetes, the doctor might be paid a set fee for the visit, the check on the feet, the blood test, and the medication teaching session. That patient teaching session, it might be done in a group setting where 3 or 4 patients work together with a nurse, thus trimming the costs. Many states have seen good results with managed care, said Matt Salo, head of the National Association of Medicaid Doctors, who called North Carolina's transition to managed care an important journey designed to refocus the healthcare system on improving outcomes. Moving to managed care means creating a public-private partnership where the accountability around better care is a joint responsibility of the state and the plans, he said. Waiting game. For now, there's little for patients to notice about the switch to managed care, but many expect there will be bumps in the road. Many patients didn't understand what was happening to their Medicaid. Despite a media blitz by DHHS, only about 15% of patients made a choice of which managed care company to have deliver their care. The rest were auto-assigned. That's actually typical across the country. "You're not going to make this big of a change without some problems," said Greg Griggs, who heads the NC Academy of Family Physicians. He said it's time to give credit to the State Department of Health and Human Services for getting everything ready to meet the deadline set by the state legislature last year Even as the department was scrambling to respond to the coronavirus pandemic, there were contracts to negotiate, people to hire, computer systems to switch over, regulations to write, and lots of federal paperwork. Making such a transition takes a lot of effort. A lot of this happens in the weeds, said Elizabeth Hudgens, head of the North Carolina Pediatric Society. And then there's figuring out how each and every plan does something just slightly different. They've been very responsive to us going into this and trying to anticipate as many problems as they have. They've had a ton of webinars for providers, Griggs said. The last couple of webinars, they've had all the chief medical officers for all the plans. All the chief medical officers have given people like me and Elizabeth Hudgens their cell phone numbers. By now, patients should have received a card in the mail listing their managed care company. The medical billers in some providers' offices need to learn the systems for the managed care companies managing their offices' patients. They're headed to online listservs and Facebook groups to ask basic questions, such as where are the patient numbers on the new cards, how can they determine eligibility for new patients, and how to submit claims. Each managed care company may be using third-party claims processors who each have different forms, different software, and different ways to submit claims for the care they've delivered. Providers may not know which managed care company their patients are covered by and are turning into endless webinars on how to learn all these new tasks. And those providers are wary. They now have to sign contracts with 2, 3, maybe even 5 managed care companies so they can see patients from around the state. From a practice perspective, you're going from contracting with Medicaid to maybe contracting with 5 different plans, Hudgens said. Griggs said he worries about the administrative burden for providers and their billing staff. The big worry, he said, is that when claims get filed, there might be snafus and delays in getting paid. That's what happened in 2014 when the state rolled out its glitchy software system, NCTRAX. Uh-oh, that's my signal from Alfred E. Newman and the usual gang of idiots. They want me to end this broadcast. So be it. But remember, every session of Indie Week is available in podcast after the initial Friday broadcast. Just visit www.ncreadingservice.org, click Listen, click Skip to Podcasts, click Independent, and then click the link at the bottom of the page. I'm Kurt Benrood, substituting for John Federson, and we both thank you for joining us for this episode of Indie Week. Please join us for future broadcasts. North Carolina Reading Service thanks you for listening in.